Hello, and welcome to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper Primary Edition for August 2019. Our thanks go to Goffby Music, who's allowed us to play the piece of music you've just heard. The news items come from this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Here's my first news item. Villagers pull together as murder probe continues. A neighbourhood remains in shock days after a village became the scene of a murder investigation, but the community has pulled together with a special church vigil. Police were first called to the village of Flamstead at 7:45 p.m. on Saturday, July the 27th, after a woman was reported missing by her family members. Officers subsequently forced their way into one of the four almshouses on the High Street and found Christine Ford suffering from multiple injuries. The 71-year-old was pronounced dead shortly afterwards. A 64-year-old man was arrested on suspicion of murder on Monday, July the 29th, and remains in custody. He has not yet been charged and is currently receiving medical assistance. Officers are guarding the property, which is cordoned off with police tape, and a forensic tent is stationed nearby. Reporters from national media organisations have been on the scene throughout the week. The BBC has reported that Christine was a former hairdresser and carer who had moved to the village from the Isle of Wight 10 years ago. One of her neighbours, who did not want to be named, said, "I felt disbelief. We came here 40 years ago. You wouldn't expect it in a village like this. I was totally unaware of it until my friend called me." A resident of Priory Orchard said, "It is a very sad day for the village." And a woman who works near the victim's house added, "This is traumatic. People are in disbelief." Paul Williams, who lives nearby in River Hill, said, "On Saturday I went into St Albans. Came back and went for a pint in the Spotted Dog. I didn't see anything unusual. I'm absolutely shocked. Nothing like this has ever happened here. I think there's been the odd burglary, that's it." The village held a vigil on Tuesday in the medieval church of St Leonard's in the High Street. Flowers were laid and candles were lit in memory of Christine, said to be a regular churchgoer. On Monday, the vicar, Reverend Tom Sander, said on social media, "Tomorrow, Tuesday, from 8 p.m, St Leonard's will be open for a vigil of light to gather ourselves in a place where hope is found. I will say a few words at 8:30. Candles will be available and you may place flowers if you wish. Everyone is welcome." The Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire and Hertfordshire Major Crime Unit has launched a murder investigation and is conducting extensive inquiries into the circumstances around Christine's death. Investigating Detective Superintendent Joanne Walker said, "This is a tragic incident and our thoughts are very much with Christine's family at this difficult time. They're being supported by specially trained family liaison officers and we are doing everything we can to determine the events that led up to her death."
Hello, I'm Jenny. My first piece says, "Insolvent foraging pub going for posthumous Best Pub Award as one last hurrah." A city centre pub which closed last week is hoping for one last hurrah by gunning for a posthumous award. The Vorilum Arms on Lower Dagnall Street declared insolvency overnight between July the 25th and the 26th, to the shock of the local community. Before it went under, the pub had been nominated for Best Pub in the St Albans Food and Drink Festival Awards 2019, and the former owners hope it's still in with a chance. A Facebook post has now asked people to vote if they support independent pubs over chains, flavour over blandness and independence over chains. The Vorilum Arms had been included for a favourite local pub list in The Guardian and in Britain's 20 Best Pubs for Foodies list by The Times. When the pub went into liquidation, more than 10 staff became redundant and unpaid for a month's work. It was owned by George Friedenham and Richard Osmond. Richard said, "The absolute worst thing about what happened is having to make everybody redundant overnight. I'm making them wait for their last paycheck. These hard-working people didn't deserve that. In fact, they are the best team we have ever had." Richard wanted to go out with a bang rather than a whimper. Wouldn't it be amazing, instead of shuffling off sadly into liquidation, this beloved local pub and wild food destination was able to rise from beyond the grave for one last night of glory and celebration, he said. There are a host of other pubs in the running, including Great Northern Pub, The Boot and The Horn. EL Fighting Cocks won the title for 2018 and they're running too. Owners of the Verulam Arms were known for offering foraging walks and feast events in St Albans, and it's now been confirmed the scheduled bookings will still go ahead in all the turmoil. Patron Frank Casey described pub's closure as heartbreaking. It's another pub in a city that's renowned for its pubs that is gone. The only people to blame are the people who haven't used it. Head of Community Services at St Albans Council, Joe Taverner, said an independent steering group usually moderate the award finalists by visiting the business, but that will not be possible for the Verulam Arms. He said, "We'll be talking to them about this situation and what to do in this case."
Hello from Mel. A historic St Albans park has reclaimed an award of international recognition after losing out last year. In 2018, for the first time since 2004, Clarence Park did not join numerous other public spaces around the district in receiving a Green Flag Award. The recognition rewards well-managed spaces, and the 19th century park lost out because there were pothole-ridden footpaths, a dirty and broken water fountain, neglected soil, an overlooked sensory garden, half-completed planting, and a pavilion in need of renovation. Portfolio holder for Community Leisure and Sports at St Albans District Council, known as the SADC, Councillor Anthony Rowland said, "We are particularly proud to regain a Green Flag Award for Clarence Park. This is a testament to the work our team, along with our grounds maintenance contractor, John O'Connor, have put in to bring Clarence Park back to its previous high standard. It joins numerous other spaces around the district to receive the Green Flag Award. These include Lytica Park, Harpenden Common, Brickett Wood Common, Hatfield Road Cemetery, Sopwell Nunnery Green Space, Greenwood Park, Jersey Farm Woodland Park and Berylanium Park, which is designated a Green Heritage Site." Harpenden Deputy Mayor and Chair of the Community Services Committee, Nicola Linacre, said, "Well-maintained green spaces are incredibly important to Harpenden residents and visitors, and the Town Council would like to thank all our volunteers, community groups and contractors for all their hard work. Their support is vital in helping us to maintain our green spaces to such a high standard for all to enjoy." St Stephen's Parish Council has just installed a new playground equipment in Greenwood Park, including a hill fort, sandpit, wide slide and climbing frames. Chairman of the Parish Council said, "The work has been going on for about 6 years and we've been awarded that green flag for that time. We know how much quality green spaces matter to residents and visitors, and this award celebrates the dedication that goes into maintaining Greenwood Park to such a high standard. We are one of only 12 parish councils in the country to gain the award, most others going to larger town."
Low water levels, blighting lake with exposed silt and covering of weeds. Years of silt build-up and weed growth have been exposed in St Albans' problematic Verulamium Lake because so little water is flowing in the River Vyr. St Albans District Council, SADC, contractors have been trying to rake up plants covering the lake water, which is connected to the Vyr chalk stream, but the tactic is proving ineffective. Recent discussions on social media have highlighted issues with the lake, which has been plagued with difficulties in recent years. For example, more than 100 ducks died of avian botulism in 2015 after a lack of flow from the River Vyr meant duck feces, leaves and natural material built up in the water and bacteria thrived. This comes as former The Undertones singer Fergal Sharkey condemned water loss from historic chalk beds in Whirling Garden City and St Albans, including the River Vyr. Fergal got involved with the cause of protecting Hart's chalk beds from his time spent angling for fish. The Derry native said, "It's dried up to a ditch. Nothing has been done for 30 years on this issue and now the beds are in a terrible state." He lays the blame squarely at the doors of the Environment Agency, EA. The EA says it has slashed the amount of water that water companies take from six chalk streams in the area north of London by over 40 million litres a day since 2016. Adding, "This is not as easy as turning off the taps. Replacing the water that comes from chalk streams is highly complex and has to be done in a way that balances the environment with the needs of consumers and maintaining public supply. SADC is currently working with EA, Affinity Water and Herts County Council's Countryside Management Services to restore the River Wear as part of the multi-million pound project revitalising the river. Proposals include reducing Verulamian Lake by a third to make room for a new stream flowing through the park. Head of Community Services at SADC, Joe Tavernier, said, "Unfortunately, Verulamian Park lakes, which were man-made in the 1930s, are currently affected by the very low water levels in the River Wear. Aquatic weed growth, common in lakes, is currently visible and collecting in corners. Our contractor, John O'Connor, is raking up the weed regularly, and we are looking into other ways to help improve collection."
Teens wanted after burglaries. Three men are wanted following a series of burglaries across Hertfordshire. The offences occurred in Harpenden, Hemel Hempstead and St Albans between April and May this year. Rhys Wheeler is 19 years old and his last known address is the High Street in Dunstable, Bedfordshire. Tyler Ogden Hooper is also 19 and is of no fixed address. George Wadsworth is 18 years old and his last known address is Hillborough Crescent in Houghton Regis, Bedfordshire. They're also wanted in connection with burglaries across the Bedfordshire and Thames Valley areas between April and May this year. Police are appealing to the public for their help in locating the three men. Anyone who has any information about their whereabouts is asked to contact the police by the 101 number.
Tribute to those who made the ultimate sacrifice on railways in First World War. A tribute to fallen railway workers has been unveiled at St Albans City Station. Govia Thames Link Railway, GTR, staff gathered with Royal British Legion members and local dignitaries on Wednesday, July the 24th, to reveal the history panel and memorial, which also marks 150 years since the station opened in 1868. It is in the waiting room on Platform 1 and lists the name, rank and regiment of railway workers who died during the First World War. There is also a larger version of the memorial at the St Albans South Signal Box. It was all researched and developed by the St Albans Signal Box Preservation Trust and the recently formed Bedford to St Albans Community Rail Partnership, CRP, and designed by Les O'Leary. CRPs are being set up across the GTR network to encourage involvement with the railway, for example, maintaining floral displays and creating community art schemes. CRP line officer Andy Buckley said, "It's important to remember the sacrifice and the history that goes with both the railway and the community it serves." Following a ribbon-cutting ceremony, St Albans Mayor Janet Smith read out the names on the plaque. A silence was observed by the attendees, the last post was played, and wreaths were laid. Councillor Smith said, "It was a great honour to be invited to the unveiling of the new history panel at St Albans City Station, especially as it pays tribute to the railway staff who lost their lives in the First World War. To read out the names of those lost was very moving indeed." Signal Box trustee Richard Kirk said, "The Trust is pleased and honoured that our history panel has been put on display at the station for all to see, especially as we've been able to incorporate a copy of our World War I memorial, as well as publicising the restoration and public openings of the Signal Box." On the same day, the Signal Box Preservation Trust signs up to become a station partner with the Bedford to St Albans CRP and received £500 from Thames Link for doing so. Thames Link and Great Northern Managing Director Tom Moran said, "We are proud to celebrate St Albans City Station's long history. The trustees and CRP have worked hard to produce a well-researched timeline of the station's history, paying tribute to those who paid the ultimate sacrifice during the Great War." There are three pictures with this article. One shows the managing director in front of the memorial. Another shows people standing at the signal box. And a final one shows Les O'Leary standing with his father's medal opposite the signal box memorial.
Here's a prickly item for you. Plucky posties help hedgehogs get out of a hole in the heat. Two St Albans posties and a dog have rescued a pair of hedgehogs from a water standpipe hole. Fallon Williams, 19, was out walking her dog Max when the pooch stopped and peered down a deep hole in the ground. She said, "I saw Max sniffing around the hole as I parked the car. I wondered what he was doing as he was really fixated, and I looked down the hole and I saw two little hedgehogs stuck in the bottom of it. on her shift as a postperson later that day, Fallon talked to her Royal Mail colleague, Mike Izzard, about the hedgehogs, and he said he knew someone who rescued them. Fallon and Mike rushed to the uncovered water pipe hole with put some gloves on, where he was able to gently pull them out. The hedgehogs, who the posties named Cheese and Pickle, were treated to a good bath and a free check-up by village vet in Smallford, and were then taken to the London Coney Hedgehog Rescue Centre, where they're now recovering. Mike said, "This is another fine example of my favourite saying, teamwork makes the dream work." Fallon added, "I was so grateful for Mike helping me to rescue them, and I'm pleased that they are now doing well." Once they are better, Esther Chant, owner of the Hedgehog Sanctuary, will release them back into the area where they were found in. Esther said, "It's a world full of problems. I think it's so heartwarming that these guys did such a heroic job saving the lives of two baby hedgehogs. With the hot weather we've had recently, they would definitely have died through dehydration and probably been attacked by flies. It's important that people look out for hedgehogs trapped in these places that should have been covered up. I would encourage people to alert the local authority to any uncovered drains or cover holes in their gardens, as they should not be there. Also, people can leave a shallow dish of water to help them stay hydrated." Mike and Fallon will be going to visit their prickly friends before they leave.
Students with disabilities won a trophy for designing an environmentally friendly sports centre. Pupils at St Luke's School in Redbourne received the award for studying environmental issues as part of a 10-week sustainability project for SEN, Special Educational Needs, schools called Go4Set. It was delivered by AkzoNobel and the Institution of Engineering and Technology. At the end of the course, St Luke's pupils designed an inclusive sports centre, produced a display stand, wrote a report and presented to industry experts. Along with another SEN school from Slough, St Luke's participants were given a Bronze Level Industrial Cadets Award and a trophy for favourite project. The Go4Set scheme was created by education charity EDT. CSR manager at AkzoNobel UK and Ireland, Alison Furness, said it is important to support inclusion in the workplace. "We are delighted to support them and the schools in championing inclusion together with awareness of science and sustainability in young people."
Chalk Stream Crisis, one of the greatest environmental scandals of our age. UK chalk stream degradation is one of the two greatest environmental scandals of this century, the House of Commons has heard. MPs discussed problems with English rivers in a recent parliamentary debate, covering water abstraction, increased home building and global warming. One of the dehydrated chalk streams under discussion was the River Ver, which runs from the edge of the Chilterns towards St Albans to join the River Colne near Brickett Wood. It feeds the problematic Verulamium Lake and has become stagnant and shallow from over-manipulation in recent history. Water in most rivers comes from rainfall, but the Ver is fed from groundwater aquifers and should be a crystal-clear, babbling brook which supports an abundance of wildlife. There are only 200 of these chalk streams in the world, 85% of which are in England, but only 25% of those are intact and of good quality. Broxbourne MP Charles Walker scheduled the debate. He said, "I find it extraordinary, given our own poor environmental record, that colleagues in this House lecture Indonesia and Brazil so freely on their responsibility to the rainforests. Of course, those two countries have a huge responsibility to the rainforests, but if we cannot save the chalk streams that are literally in our own backyard, what are we doing lecturing other countries on their environmental responsibilities?" Members of the Ver Valley Society recently recorded that water levels were 8 metres below the long-term average in May. It's been 4 years since the average was above what is expected. In a tweet, they urged St Albans MP Anne Main to attend the parliamentary debate, but she did not take part. Mrs Main said that she was disappointed to have missed it. "I had several meetings that I had committed to, and I was due to chair a debate in Westminster Hall that afternoon too. I've been in touch with several constituents who have written to me about this issue in recent weeks. Last week I wrote to the Environment Secretary about the River Ver and the importance of retaining and protecting our chalk streams. We must not abuse our precious chalk streams with over-abstraction, and we need proper water conservation measures in place to ensure they are protected. I'll be inviting the new Secretary of State to visit the River Ver with me, and I hope she will accept my offer."
Businesses get creative for charity. St Albans businesses are encouraging people to get creative to raise money for charity. The Businesses Community, TBC, St Albans, are picking up paintbrushes, crayons, glitter, feathers and more to support Home Start Hearts, JDRF Diabetes and MND Association. TBC founder Sue Widrow said, "Sometimes we are just so busy with life, work, family, social media, rushing here, rushing there, that we thought it was time to stop, take stock and have a bit of me time. Anyone is welcome to take part and register with TBC to get their canvas. Finished canvases will be on display in an exhibition at Rothamsted Enterprise on Friday, September the 20th from 4:30pm to 6:30pm. Visitors can place silent bids starting at £5 on any piece of art. Profits from the event will be split between the three charities."
A St Albans girl has been crowned Miss Junior Teen of Hertfordshire. Megan Gibbon has now won a place in the final of Miss Junior Teen Great Britain 2019. The teenager, who lives in Markgate, beat hundreds of teens from across the country to make it to the grand final stage. Her mum, Anna Shaw, said, "Megan is feeling excited and nervous for the finals, but is very proud to be representing her local area. She's working hard in her local community, raising Together for Short Lives and be holding several other events this summer. The winner of Miss Junior Teen Great Britain will come away with prizes, including £500 cash, dresses from the dress studio, a crown and a sash. The final weekend is set to include a beauty contest, challenging day, pyjama party at a hotel and an on-stage finale event. It will be held in October, the 20th, in Blackpool."
Famous plant biologist's grave is lovingly restored. The St Albans gravestone of a world-renowned plant biologist has been restored by a local history group. Fleetville Diaries held an event to commemorate the life of Henry Frederick Conrad Sander, a famous 19th to 20th century German orchid breeder. Nicknamed the Orchid King, he developed the difficult science of orchid hybridisation and wrote a four-volume series of books called Reichenbachia. Detailing about 200 orchid varieties, the majority of Reichenbachia was intricately illustrated by Henry Moon. Various breeds of orchid are named after the German-born gardener, such as Anthurium Laukianum Sander and Maranta Sanderiana Sander. According to Hertfordshire Genealogy, Sander settled in England in 1867 and took over Messrs. S. Jostling's seed business on George Street in the mid-1870s. Over time, Sander created an orchid empire in the camp and employed about 23 collectors to search Asia and South America for new species. He went on to supply orchids to royal families and stately homes in purpose-built orchid wagons. The Sander family grave, which is in Hatfield Road Cemetery, had fallen into disrepair before the Fleetville Diaries restored it. Committee member David Gaylard said, "The grave was in a very poor condition. It had a huge buddleia growing out of it. It was very overgrown and full of brambles, and the memorials had been knocked over. So we thought we should restore it, as it is a remarkable part of history." It is not surprising that many people may not know about Sander, but it is important to remember him, because he is a part of St Albans. About 90 people attended the commemorative event on July the 23rd at St Paul's Church on Hatfield Road, including Matt Biggs, who is on BBC Radio 4's Gardener's Question Time. It was a unique opportunity to celebrate the life, legacy and extraordinary achievements of Frederick Sander, who for many decades turned St Albans into the centre of the orchid world. Members of Sander's family, including Reichenbachia illustrator Henry Moon and Sander's two daughters, also attended the event.
Now we have some news about the Lord Lieutenant of Hertfordshire, who will be presenting the Queen's Award to us in September. No better time for Lord Lieutenant to be patron of hospice. The Lord Lieutenant of Hertfordshire has become the patron of a hospice supporting people across the county and beyond. Robert Voss is now a patron of the Hospice of St Francis in Berkhamsted, which supports 2,000 local people in Hertfordshire and Buckinghamshire. Mr. Voss, who was awarded a CBE for services to British industry and voluntary work in the Queen's New Year's Honours List in 2014, has been supporting the hospice for some time. As well as formally and informally visiting the hospice, Mr. Voss also gave a thank you address to dinner guests at a recent 40th anniversary dinner at Hatfield House. At a Caribbean Women's Standing Conference gala dinner auction last year, he successfully bid for a pastel painting and donated it to the charity. The piece was created in 2004 by the late Hemel Hempstead artist Christine Hillier and is the sister to one which was already hanging in the hospice's inpatient unit. He gifted the painting to bring pleasure to patients, their families and everyone who visits. Mr. Voss said, "I'm delighted to become a patron of the Hospice of St. Francis. I have known the wonderful St. Francis team for some time and have greatly admired their dedication and the care they have for their patients and their families. The atmosphere around St. Francis is one of love and support, and I look forward to helping build on that ethos." The Hospice of St. Francis received the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service this year, and Mr. Voss will present it to them in September. Hospice CEO Kate Phipps Wiltshire said, "Securing Mr. Voss's support couldn't come at a better time for our hospice. We are celebrating 40 years of helping people live their precious lives well this summer, yet need everyone's help in fortifying us for future generations, both in terms of supporting our funding, instigating new collaborations, and ensuring outstanding hospice care is a reality for those that need it. Robert is passionate about raising the profile of the hospice movement within Hertfordshire, already setting up a hospital and hospices panel, and is committed to doing what he can to help us start conversations and spread the message about the important role hospices play in our county and across the UK."
There's a lovely picture with my article. It's a group of lots of children on rugs and parents with prams, all sitting around and running around and enjoying the woods, it seems. And the article says, "If you go down to Harpenden's Lydecker Park this summer, you'll be sure of a big surprise. There'll be a range of free activities on offer at the annual Teddy Bears Picnic in Harpenden this summer. Children are encouraged to bring along their favourite soft toy to enjoy the event too. Attendees can enjoy face painting, a bouncy castle, soft play, crafts, circus skills with Showtime Circus, a Teddy Bears hospital, and just for kids, live entertainment from Imagica Theatre. The event has been organised by Harpenden Town Council in partnership with Lyndhurst Financial Management, the company which sponsored the Lively in Lydecker Summer event series. Director of Lyndhurst Financial Management, Jeff Newman, said, "The Teddy Bears Picnic should be a great occasion to celebrate Harpenden's fantastic green spaces. The Teddy Bears Picnic will take place on August the 7th in Lydecker Park from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Booking is not required."
County to consider environmental impact of Luton Airport's expansion. Environmental concerns may affect the expansion of Luton Airport in a potential review of Hart's County Council's policy. Councillor Derek Ashley, Executive Member for the Environment, Planning and Transport, signalled there could be a review of policy in relation to the airport's growth, allowing for greater weight to be given to protecting the environment. The issue was raised in a full council meeting by Conservative Councillor Annie Brewster, who is also a member of the St Albans District Council. She particularly highlighted Luton Airport's expansion plans. Councillor Ashley, speaking on the same day the County Council declared a climate emergency, said, "Council has always taken the view that economic benefits needed to be balanced with the impact on the environment, both on the ground and in the air. However," he suggested, "in future, greater weight should be given to environmental concerns." He said, "I think the balance is now shifting more towards the environmental issues and away from strictly economic issues that I think were priorities in the past. So I agree that we do now need to look at how we view airport expansion, the impact on the ground, and the impact relative to climate change, and whether the environmental impact now takes a much higher priority than perceived economic benefits." Councillor Ashley accepted that in recent years there had been a much bigger increase in passenger numbers than anticipated, and larger planes, with more passengers on every flight, were having a substantial impact in the air and on the ground. At the meeting, Councillor Brewster pointed to the airport's ambition to expand to accommodate 32 million passengers a year, and the impact of low-flying planes on communities. She said, "I believe our policy was to avoid the building of an additional runway at Luton, but not designed to encourage the packing of every second with maximum aircraft movement." Councillor Andy Malcolm, chair of the London Luton Airport Limited, said, "We're absolutely committed to developing our proposal in the right way, and that way is making sure our strategies for minimising and mitigating environmental impacts are the very best they can be, and fully consulting with our communities."
A Harpenden couple in their 90s have celebrated 70 years of marriage. Ray and Mavis Gamlin of Poets' Corner met on a train in Arbroath when Ray was travelling to his engineer Navy training. The wedding was on July the 30th at St Margaret's Church, Dundee, in 1949. They celebrated the day with a meal with family and friends. Mavis said her and Ray could not always get married quarters in the Navy, and so they lived in a caravan for 9 years. They went on to have 3 children, 2 grandchildren, and are due to be great-grandparents soon. After serving in the Navy, Ray volunteered for Harpenden Helping Hand, where he won an award for running the transport system, which was presented to him at Buckingham Palace. Mavis said, "We are so lucky to have had a very happy marriage and 3 lovely children. I am 91 and Ray is 90, so he always calls himself my toy boy."
Classics on the Common. Fleet of cars descend on town for event. Hundreds of vintage vehicles drove into Harpenden for the 26th year of a popular charity event. It is estimated that about 10,000 people attended Classics on the Common 2019, which was held on Harpenden Common on July the 24th. With 800 cars on display across the fields, Harpenden Rotary Club were raising money for 4 main charities. Samaritans of Luton, Southbeds and Harpenden, Alzheimer's Society, Carers in Hertfordshire and the Rotary Doctor Bank. Although the fundraising total has not yet been calculated, previous years with similarly sunny days raised more than £30,000 for good causes. Rotary and Harpenden committee member Ridley Whitfield said, "It went very well. We were delighted with the number of people who came with their cars and delighted with the number of spectators. It's a popular event. The weather was gorgeous and lots of people turned up, especially as it's held in the middle of the week." He said the event originated in 1994 when a small group of friends had lunch on the common with their vintage cars. Rotary in Harpenden took it over in 2009 and the event now attracts large crowds each year. Accompanied by a range of photographs, including those of cars. There's a Ford from, none of them are captioned, there's a Ford from, I'd guess, about 1920, some cars from early 1900s, right the way through to some of the sleeker ones from the 1970s. And there's the most fabulous aerial picture of the common, which has rows and rows and rows of cars pretty much filling it.
Closure order imposed on flat after Class A drugs arrests. A closure order has been secured on a London Coney flat after 3 people were arrested on suspicion of Class A drug offences. Following ongoing antisocial behaviour and suspected drug dealing at an address in Reed Close, officers from the St Albans Community Safety Unit were successful in securing a 3-month closure order at St Albans Magistrates Court on Thursday, July the 25th. It means that nobody besides Alderwick Housing Association and the emergency services can enter the flat until October the 24th, and anyone who breaches this order could be arrested. The order was granted after intelligence was received to suggest property was being used for suspected drug dealing and taking. Following the execution of a drugs warrant on July the 11th, an amount of suspected Class A drugs was seized, as well as supply bags and scales. A 40-year-old woman and a 53-year-old man, both from London Coney, were arrested on suspicion of being concerned in the supply of Class A drugs and handling stolen goods. A 37-year-old man was also arrested on suspicion of being concerned in the supply of Class A drugs. All 3 have been released under investigation, pending further inquiries. Sergeant Mike Saunders from the St Albans Community Safety Unit said, "As well as working with Alderwick, we also worked with residents whose quality of life was compromised by ongoing antisocial behaviour, which included vehicles turning up at the address at antisocial hours throughout the night. We are committed to doing everything in our power to deal with suspected drug use and antisocial behaviour, and a closure order is a significant step in giving residents their quality of life back. If you have information about suspected drug activity and antisocial behaviour in your neighbourhood, please do not hesitate to report it to us, because we will take it seriously and we will do all we can to prevent it from adversely affecting the lives of decent, law-abiding people who live nearby. He added, I want to further reassure local residents that we will continue to monitor the situation and take further action if necessary.
A St Albans construction manager has been shortlisted for a prestigious industry award. John Aldsworth is up for Construction Manager of the Year at the Chartered Institute of Building Awards 2019. He's worked for Wilmot Dixon for 11 years and managed the St Albans Museum and Gallery Conversion Project. There have been three rounds of judging already, including a site visit and panel interview. John said he would do it again tomorrow. With a 200-year-old Grade 2 listed building, he said there are so many unknowns and so much can go wrong, which made our client and their team understandably nervous. He will be able to find out if he has won in September. Councillor Annie Brewster, who was Sports and Culture portfolio holder at St Albans Council at the time, said he led a very professional team from the front, took on all the challenges a complex restoration and repurposing of a historic building can throw up, and he made it all look effortless while supporting everyone around him. There's a lovely photo of him standing outside the town hall with Annie Brewster holding a nice bottle of champagne to celebrate its opening.
A St Albans homelessness charity has teamed up with a garden centre to find new ways to support people in the district. Open Door, which is based in Brickett Road, is encouraging Knotcuts customers to make a small donation to the charity when they are about to pay by rounding up their bill to the nearest pound. This month, Knotcuts General Manager Chris Holt met with Open Door Chairman Kerry Pollard and St Albans Mayor Councillor Janet Smith, who both thanked the Garden Centre for introducing the scheme. The donations have already raised several thousand pounds to support the charity's work. Manager Steve France also raised £5,000 for the charity by taking part in a sponsored sleep out and has volunteered to work in Open Door's kitchen. Steve said, for several years I'd wanted to do something to help the homeless and rough sleepers.
Now we come to next week's radio programmes, which you may like to listen to. Here are some choices for your summer listening as we move into August. We begin with those programmes serialised throughout the week. Usually these would run from Monday to Friday, but as we are now in the prom season, there is a concert from the Royal Albert Hall each day from 7:30pm on Radio 3. There is the usual eclectic mix ending on Friday with a prom dedicated to the golden age of Hollywood. And now, here are the serialised programmes from Monday the 5th of August to Friday the 9th of August. I think that some of us who tend to wake early appreciate a programme either to accompany an early breakfast instead of the Today programme, or as background for that extra snooze. And this week, Amol Rajan has chat, guests and music from 6:30am on Radio 2. The book of the week on Radio 4 is at 9:45am and is A Woman of Firsts, the memoir of Edna Aden Ismail, the former foreign minister and first lady of Somaliland. It's repeated at 12:30pm. The 15-minute drama at 10:45am on Radio 4 is Curious Under the Stars, the ninth run of the comedy drama set in a small Welsh village. It's repeated at 7:45pm. The reading at 12:04pm and repeated at 10:45pm is Ulverton by Adam Thorpe. The novel is set in Berkshire from 1650 to the 1980s. The readings, in 10 parts, are bookended by dramatisations on Sundays, the 4th and the 17th of August, at 3pm on Radio 4. The composer of the week is at 1pm on Radio 3 during the prom season. This week, it's Meredith Monk. The TED interview is this week's 1:45pm slot on Radio 4. TED stands for Technology, Entertainment and Design, so the interviews will be wide-ranging. Classic FM offers the Full Works concert each evening at 8pm. My individual daily choices start on Saturday, the 3rd of August, with Hindle Wakes, an adaptation of the 1910 play set in Lancashire. This can be heard at 4pm on Radio 4 Extra. People Talking on Radio 4 Extra at 7pm is an exploration of the BBC archives by Fi Glover, who has searched out everyday stories from wartime Vox Pops through to today's snapshots of life.
You're listening for Sunday, 4th August, could start at 1:30pm on Radio 4 with Fence Me In, when Adam Fowler records how the creativity of artists is affected by the acoustics of a space. The wonderful Beryl Reid can be heard in conversation with Sian Phillips at 3:45pm on Radio 4 Extra. And in the first of four programmes, Richard Littlejohn of the Daily Mail pinpoints The Years That Changed Britain. The series begins in 1972 and can be heard at 9pm on Radio 2. Monday, 5th August, has an interesting start on Radio 4, 9am with Reflections with Peter Hennessy. His guest this week is the always interesting and entertaining Alan Johnson, the postman turned Labour MP. At 11am on Radio 4, Hearing Homelessness has Hugh Huddy, who lost his sight aged 20, meeting homeless people and using binaural sound captures the world they hear. If you have been following the adventures of Benjamin Quartet in the 2:15 drama on Radio 4 called 4/4, then today has the last episode. Keris Matthews has her regular blues show on Radio 2 at 9pm.
On Tuesday, 6th of August at 9am on Radio 4, you can listen to Fry's English Delight, which returns when Stephen Fry offers his thoughts on the alphabet, word and order, and the role of the exclamation mark. It's repeated at 9:30pm. Power of Deceit at 11am on Radio 4 considers deception and cunning in the animal and human kingdoms. In His Kiss at 2:15pm on Radio 4 is a comedy drama about an Irish comedian who joins a dating site to look for material for her stand-up show. Still on Radio 4, there are three interesting programmes for tea time listening, starting at 3:30 with Peter White's No Triumph, No Tragedy, followed at 4pm by Word of Mouth, where Michael Rosen connects 18th century philosophy to modern advertising slogans. And the last of the trio is Great Lives, where Matthew Paris talks with Ed Balls about his interest in the life and music of Herbert Howells. Time for Laughter returns at 6:30, when Andy Hamilton sort of remembers, and this week reflects on religion. More comedy this time on Radio 4 Extra, also at 6:30pm, with Dad Made Me Laugh, when Jenny Seacombe recalls her father Harry, and this is immediately followed at 7pm by The Al Reed Show, and at 7:30 with To the Manor Born. For jazz lovers, Jamie Callum plays a broad spectrum of jazz music at 9pm on Radio 2. Choices for Wednesday the 7th of August start at 9am on Radio 4 with A Singer's Guide to Britain, when different aspects of British culture are explored through the songs we sing. This is the first of a four-part series. It's repeated again at 9:30pm. Comedy at 11:30am on Radio 4 with All Those Women, which tells of four generations of women living in the same house. It's a repeat from 2018, but Rumpole of the Bailey will always be entertaining. You can hear Rumpole and the Golden Thread at 2:15pm on Radio 4. Still with the law, but on a more serious note, Unreliable Evidence returns to Radio 4 at 8pm. Tonight's subject is citizenship, focusing on the case of Shamima Begum. The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe is at 9pm on Radio 2, and Radio 3 at 9:30 has Exit Burbage, the man who created Hamlet. Andrew Dickinson talks to actors and searches archives to discover Burbage's crucial role.
Thursday, the 8th of August, has Her Story Made History at 9am on Radio 4. Lise Doucette interviews Ugandan politician Betty Bigombe about her role in negotiating peace with a brutal warlord. You may like to stay with Radio 4 for the programme which follows at 9:45am. In One to One, Jonathan Aitken is interviewed by Alan Rusbridger about his incarceration for perjury and perverting the course of justice. The Art of Now, Batter Batter, is the second programme this week about sound. This time, the world of sound making is explored, from audio innovators to people with disabilities crafting work for an experimental radio station. The 2:15pm drama on Radio 4 is The Summer Snows. A writer sets out from Dorset to the Scottish Highlands, seeking the last remnants of winter. Open Country at 3pm on Radio 4 finds out about the significance of various landmarks. The always interesting Making History, 8pm on Radio 4, this week follows the history of bread lines and bread. Radio 3 at 10pm has Tony Harrison's Prague Spring, in which one of our best-known poets returns to Prague to relive stories of hope and despair during the 1960s, when the Soviets were fought with words, plays and self-sacrifice. The first broadcast from this year's Edinburgh International Festival is on Friday, the 9th of August. The live piano recital at 11am on Radio 3 from the Queen's Hall features evocations of the fairy tale world of Nordic folklore with pieces by Grieg. Also at 11am, but on Radio 4, Peterloo, The Massacre That Changed Britain, looks at the aftermath of the massacre and the impact it has had on British life in the subsequent decades. Hazel Tours, a comedy written by the creators of Claire in the Community, features a local historian living in the Scottish borders. It is at 11:30am on Radio 4. The Interrogation at 2:15pm on Radio 4 concludes the current series with an interview with Carly, who has bitten a police officer. Two back-to-back programmes, which are always of interest, can be found from 4pm on Radio 4, starting with The Last Word, which celebrates the lives of notable people who have recently died. And at 4:30pm, Roger Bolton presents Feedback, when you can hear, and perhaps contribute to, listeners' views on the week's broadcasts. In a week when concerts of film music have been prominent in the schedules, the final one comes at 8pm on Radio 2, when Friday Night is Music Night features film music from the 1980s. I hope you have an enjoyable week's listening.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts Advertiser. Rewilding, the future? Every now and then a book comes along that changes the way you look at the world and informs the rest of your life forever. I read just such a book recently, and I know that I will be revisiting it over the years to come, not just to remind myself of the details, but also to relive the experience and recapture the excitement and freshness of the first read. The book in question is Isabella Tree's Wilding, an eloquent and engaging account of the transition of the Nepa State in West Sussex from intensive farming to a rewilded state. In the late 90s, Nep was failing as an intensive farm, battling difficult clay soils and competition from huge-scale farms, but was thrown a lifeline in the form of European funding for the restoration of an area of parkland. The move away from intensive farming began a journey of discovery into the unknown, as nature was allowed, often unintentionally, to take the lead. As the intensive farm monoculture loosened its grip on the land, so nature often swiftly began to rewire the ecosystem. Grass was no longer cut, fields no longer ploughed, and hedges no longer flailed. The soil, and with it insects, were freed from the biased tyranny of fertilisers and pesticides. As the land began to move towards scrub and populate with new trees, free-ranging cattle, pigs and deer were introduced to browse the new growth, allowing a rich kind of wood pasture to develop. The joy of the book is in how quickly nature returns and appears to heal itself, providing solutions to problems that until that point had everyone scratching their heads. It seemed just a little loosing of the grip of human control produced an exponential release of wildlife beyond even the expectations of the experts. Two of our most threatened and iconic bird species, the nightingale and turtle dove, have returned of their own accord and in good numbers. Butterflies have also been something of a phenomenon at Nep, with an unprecedented migratory swarm of painted lady butterflies in 2009, and the establishment of what is now the UK's largest colony of the rare and beautiful purple emperor butterflies. At the heart of the wilding story is the reinstatement of nature's control as key to its own well-being. The great revelation of the rewilding project at Nep has been nature's ability to not only recover quickly, but to spontaneously revitalise and create opportunities for other species that have been absent or even never present at all. A case in point is the purple emperor colony that until 2009 had never been recorded at Nep. However, the emergence of sallow, a kind of willow, provided the perfect conditions for the butterflies to colonise. In the words of Isabella Tree, "We had accidentally created the right conditions, the randomness upon which natural pulses like sallow mast thrive." Of course, the project at Nep has not been without its challenges, and perhaps one of the biggest is simply the fact of mess. To allow nature to flourish in this way requires a letting go of that great human love, tidiness. But I think it is here that the real power of wilding lies. The book does not take us on a journey of woe and guilt, demanding of us that we let go of everything, but instead shares an inspiring journey with all its challenges of joy and surprise at the unexpected revival of nature. Something deep within us stirs, that is not just a longing for a richer natural world, but a hope that it might be achievable and not as difficult as we thought. Almost subconsciously, I have not mown our lawn since reading the book in the spring. I can't even say that it was a planned decision, but somewhere along the way, I left the mower in the shed to see what would happen. I can't claim turtle doves and nightingales, but I have enjoyed the increased buzz of bees and a visiting meadow brown butterfly. I can also revel in the huge variety of different grasses in the lawn, unidentifiable when mown, and comfort my tidy self with the fact that the lawn is reseeding itself, free of charge.
Right, this is Peter Burley. I'm bringing you the preview of events, though I suspect not as many as I'd like, for the period mid-August to mid-September. Before I start, I'll just mention a personal anecdote. Sadly, I had to go to a funeral of a colleague this week, but he led a very multifaceted life. And at the funeral, someone said, "You'll discover things about him you never knew." And how right they were, because I discovered he had set up the Southend Talking Newspaper for the Blind. And I never knew that, despite working with him for 20 years. He was a very modest man, and he never mentioned the range of activities he took part in. But a very satisfying memory. Right, well, now, going to my events. This is the time of the year when I'm slightly hung out to dry on what is publicised enough in advance. So I've only got one event at the Maltings, and there are none yet publicised for the Abbey Theatre, and nothing yet for St Peter's Church and its concerts, though I strongly suspect the lunchtime concerts will be in full swing by the time we get to September. So let's go to some music I do know is on. And the first one is going to be on Sunday afternoon, and it's an organ recital in the cathedral at 3 p.m. given by Tom Winnipenny. Admission is free and with a retiring collection. Then we have a second organ recital on Monday the 26th of August. This is at 1 p.m. and that's given by Stephen Tharp, who is an international concert organist from the USA. And we have a third event, which is yet another organ recital. And that's going to be on Sunday the 8th of September at 3 p.m. and that's given by Marco Sever, who's an organ scholar at the cathedral. Now, it's organs all the way as far as music is concerned, because we've got two events at the Organ Theatre. The first is on Saturday the 10th of August, when there's a theatre organ concert at 7:30 p.m. given by David Ivory, who is a popular East Anglian organist with a second half theme, films of the 50s. Of course, it's the pianists who tinkle the ivories, so it wouldn't be appropriate to mention that. Now, the second event is on Sunday the 11th of August, and it's one of their musical afternoons, and it features the collection of mechanical instruments. Doors open at 2 p.m, and it's a themed afternoon featuring hits from stage and screen. And actually, we've got a third bite of a cherry, because there's another open afternoon on Sunday the 8th of September, again featuring the mechanical musical instruments, and again doors opening at 2 p.m. I've got one other type of concert, only one. I suspect there will be others, but I don't know about them. And it's Stage, which is the St Albans Jazz Ensemble, and they are a big band, jazz band. There's more than 10 of them, and they'll be performing at the Maltings on the 5th of September at 8 p.m. Entry to their jazz concert will be £10. Now, let's look at the arena, and there's only two events because they're shut down last most of the late summer. And the first one is a Bee Gees tribute concert on Thursday the 12th of September at 7:30 p.m. It's called You Win Again, and all tickets for it are £27. And the second event is on Friday the 13th of September, and it's La Vida Loca, which is a highly acclaimed concert-style production featuring music of the world's most popular Latin artists. So it's tributes to artists such as Santana, Gypsy King, Gloria Estefan, Ricky Martin, and so on. Show starts at 7:30 p.m. and it doesn't unfortunately say how much the tickets are going to be, and that's partly because the arena hasn't yet published its autumn programme. However, I'm on firmer ground in Harpenden, where their programme does run on to the end of September, and we have two concerts in September at the Public Hall Harpenden. The first is on Friday the 6th, 7:30 p.m, doors open 6:30 p.m. And it's called Focus, who are a prog rock group who are appreciated by all Dutch pop rock, says exports. I suspect they mean experts. So it's doors open 7:30, all tickets £23.50, and it's a seated concert. And then we have the second one is a tribute concert to the Carpenters. We've only just begun, and it's a celebration of the life and music of Karen Carpenter. And that's going to be on Thursday the 11th of September, 7:30 p.m, doors open 6:30 p.m. All seats are £25, and it's all seated. It's performed actually by Tony Lee, who recreates, it says here, the astonishing voice of Karen Carpenter. I'm pleased to read that, because we went to a Cat Stevens tribute concert there, because Jenny is a huge fan of Cat Stevens, and the tribute artist didn't sound remotely like Cat Stevens. Now, for some outdoor events, because it will be late summer, and the first one I've got for you is the St Albans Vegan Fair. And this is going to be held at Westminster Lodge, so it's a big outdoor event. It's going to be on the 26th of August, starts at 10 in the morning, runs through to 4 in the afternoon. There is an admission charge of £3 for it. Then we've got what's becoming an annual event, the Merakai Festival, and that's going to be in the Hart Showground at Redbourne, and that runs over the weekend from the 23rd to the 25th of August. So it's 3 days. You can buy tickets either for all 3 days or one day at a time, and it's got quite a large lineup. People I've heard of include Paul Young and Carol Decker, who was the lead singer of Tapao, and various other bands, and with some live comedy. Sean Locke is a name that springs to mind on that score. So a lot going on over a long weekend there. Now, slightly more sedate, let's have some of the Fleetville Diaries guided talks and lectures and events. Saturday the 17th of August at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there's a guided walk in the cemetery off Hatfield Row with Mike Labour and Liz Bloom, and it's entitled Laid to Rest, and it's on the theme of family and friends. And if you're not a member of Fleetville Diaries, they will ask you for a contribution of £4. Then Fleetville Diaries give a good prompt that the weekend from Friday the 13th through to Sunday the 15th of September is Heritage Open weekend. And at 2 o'clock on the 14th, that's a Saturday, there's going to be an exhibition on the Bolito Hosiery Mill. Please come along to see our archive material and share your memories. So some listeners might actually be a very welcome asset if you make your way to the Fleetville Community Centre then. Admission is free, and if you are a local resident, I'm sure they'd be delighted to hear from you. Something very different. The Mormon Road Methodist Church is starting up another season of its Thinking Lunches. So you have someone who gives a talk and leads a discussion. They're free, and the first one is on Thursday the 5th of September when the Reverend Ruth Eldridge will be talking about the church and the disabled. And let's just run over this. You need to bring your own sandwiches, but tea, coffee or squash are provided. Interestingly, it doesn't say when they start. It suggests parking in the Maltings, getting to the Maltings car park for 12:30 p.m, which suggests to me that it starts slightly after 12:30. Sorry about that. I should have read that more carefully, and they should have put the information in their programme. Right, again, slightly surer ground here. We've got one event at Gorhambury House in our period. It's on Wednesday the 11th of September, 10:30 a.m. to noon, and the Countess Grimston will be talking about Gorhambury, its architectural history and refurbishment. Ticket prices for that will be £15. Now, some outdoor events in Harpenden. We have a summer fair on the Common, 23rd to 26th of August. That might be something you want to avoid, but no, that's very churlish of me, isn't it? Then we have an event called Music in Lydecker, and that's on Saturday the 31st of August. This is the second year they've had a music festival in Lydecker Park, which is just to the north of the central part of Harpenden. The event runs from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and it's free. You are asked to bring your own deck chair and your own lunch. Then we have the South Down Festival, and that's running from the 6th to the 8th of September. It's a lively weekend packed with various events as live music, food, comedy, quizzes and much, much more. And finally, we have the Harpenden Street Food Social, and that's on Saturday the 14th. And there's a street fair featuring a lot of different foods and showcasing some of the restaurants and food outlets that are available in Harpenden. We went last year and it was very enjoyable, so I recommend that. The last event I'll bring to you is new for this year, and it's called Pub in the Park, and it takes place in St Albans in Verulamium Park, centred on the Inn on the Park. It runs from the 13th through to the 15th of September, and it says it's the biggest celebration of great food, award-winning pubs, Michelin-starred chefs and live music. I think that's probably the biggest in St Albans rather than in the world, but let's just see what they're doing. Now, it's hosted by Tom Kerridge, who's now quite a well-known TV chef. And apart from him, there'll be Andrew Knights from Dillon's in King's Arms in George Street. Cathy Morano and Hawkins will also be featured. Music will be provided by Tom O'Dell, Razorlight and Will Young. You can buy your tickets in advance, either presumably from the Pub in the Park or from their website, which is pubintheparkuk.com. And I think we'll try and get along there because that sounds like quite an interesting, large and new event, well worth supporting. So I hope you enjoy yourselves and don't eat too much over the late summer.
Helen Burridge is manager of the Business Improvement District, St Albans BID, as it's properly known, and she's back with me. Last time we were chatting about retail and the sort of bricks and clicks concept. Now, this time, you want to talk about the community and I say who runs it, but who is the community?
I think in St Albans, we're really lucky to have a really engaged local population who express their myriad thoughts and opinions about the city and how it changes on social media. And so it will be as much that vocal online community as the people that come out for festivals and come out for events and the population that enjoys calling St Albans their home.
But who's really dictating what we look like? Because we've just had a great new cultural asset, the museum and gallery, opened. We're going to have more being done at the cathedral fairly soon, the visitor centre and so on. So we've got these big iconic buildings that are key.
It's interesting. So in St Albans, the local community has a choice in its leisure time. a particularly generous choice. We've got Cambridge on our doorstep. We've got London even closer on our doorstep. We've got these gorgeous countryside around us. And most of the visitors to St. Albans are actually what's called the VFR audience, which is the visiting friends and relations. And so what happens with tourism in St. Albans at the moment is that it's a lot of messaging to the local community, the local residents, when they have visitors come to visit them, to not take them into London all the time, to not take them out into the countryside, but to keep them within the district and to showcase the city. I think a lot of people do that. I think when their friends come to visit, they do want to take them around the town. They do want to take them to a local pub, take them around the parks, show them what they've got. Show them what we've got and how we share that asset. The challenge that we have, though, is that that VFR audience can only ever really be finite. Not least of all, people's houses are becoming a bit more crowded. We have a bit of a shortage of beds, which is why the renovation of the BHS building into a hotel is so welcome. But I think also there is the other audiences that are ripe for St. Albans. There's been a gap in the past between the aspiration of some of the local businesses in St. Albans and the funding that's been available for tourism. And so the tourism budgets have been very squeezed. I think it's a really exciting time for St. Albans in terms of the offer that we have. We've been using this phrase 2,000 years of visible history. We've been talking about the Verulamium Museum is one of the most visited schools museums in the southeast. It has more visitors than the Imperial War Museum at Duxford. It's an extraordinary asset. The number of kids that go through that museum is brilliant. We don't really talk about that. We think that everyone knows about the Romans, but they don't really. If you talk about Romans, you think about Roman York or you think about the City of London. People don't tend to think about St. Albans outside of St. Albans as a Roman city. We have the War of the Roses asset. We have the golf sporting asset. We've got the museum and gallery. We've got the cathedral to Britain's first saint with the longest nave in Europe. We've got Britain's oldest pub. We've got these amazing Tudor buildings. We've got the Charter Market. We've got retail. We've got this incredible offer, as well as the parks and green spaces, as well as the villages around it. But pulling that together into a succinct package that people understand has been a bit of a challenge. And I think in olden days, 15, 20 years ago, a destination management organisation, a DMO, would be responsible for deciding what that message is and then broadcasting it should the budget be there. And although St. Albans has done that to an extent, particularly with the VFR audience, I don't know whether the local community might feel sometimes that tourism is a dirty word, or at least that it's somehow sort of tawdry or not a valuable way to attract somebody to a city. I'm not really sure, but I think there's a turn now. People don't tend to buy stuff. We talked about this before, the clicks to bricks. People want to, as Canterbury's recent destination management plan has said, people want to do fun things in old places. And I think St. Albans is on the cusp of being a absolutely brilliant attraction. The line that I want to promote, and I think makes a lot of sense, is the best day trip from London. Nobody at the moment is claiming that as their headline. For people who come from far-flung places, I'm thinking the Chinese audiences, the American audiences who want to see Britain in a week, they often do a week in London and they'll pop out to do one place. At the moment, York, Canterbury, Shakespeare Country, you know, all those kinds of things. I think that we could claim that day trip. It's completely manageable, particularly if you've got jet lag. You've got 2,000 years of history. You've got all the different bits. You've got your cathedral city, your Romans, your Tudors, your market. That little bit of regional, the Heritage Lottery Fund has funded an enormous amount of investment in the city centre. So they've got the museum and the cathedral. They suggested that we should claim it as the best free day trip from London. Those kinds of decisions need to be taken, I think, pretty soon, so that we don't get left further behind.
By free, you mean you can get into all these places or see the areas that you're walking through free of charge?
There's no charge to the cathedral entrance, yeah. And there won't be to the new Welcome Centre. There's no charge for the 90% of what happens at the museum and gallery. The market obviously doesn't charge. Winchester Cathedral charges to walk through the door. Your Vic Centre charges. Verulamium Museum is a couple of pounds. I think in terms of that as an attraction, I don't know about your other listeners, but I've got a young family. If I know I'm going somewhere there, the entrance ticket is 50 quid, I'll take a picnic and I'm not spending anything when I get there. If I know we're going somewhere where actually it's a nice open space and there's places to see that don't cost me additional money, I'll probably buy lunch when I'm there. And I think people will be more willing to spend and probably spend more than they would do on an entry ticket if they feel that what they're getting without additional cost is really attractive. And so I think the way that the city can talk about its offer is changing. But at the same time as we are consolidating our offer, there's this incredible force afoot in the form of social media and Instagram and influencers and Pinterest about St. Albans and about tourism in general, where other people are making decisions, forming opinions and curating our city in a way that we don't have control over.
Give us some context, because I'm immediately thinking museum and gallery. It opens in a building that you can't do a huge amount with, but they've done a fantastic job with what was there. I mean, knock walls down, they couldn't break through. You've got to keep the courtroom, all those things.
Mm.
And then you get letters to the press saying, oh, it's rubbish, it hasn't got all the exhibits out. That they've got, you know, they've got cellars full of exhibits and they're not on show. Well, the reason is the building's not big enough to have everything.
But also, I don't think that's what people necessarily want. They want different experiences every time. They don't want to see a load of exhibits with labels that they have to read things out. They want to have fun in old places. People want to have a romp around a courtroom. I experienced this 10 years ago when I used to work in arts education. I worked for an art gallery doing their education program, and I was constantly in a push me pull you between the marketing department and the curators, because there is still a degree of anxiety between the intellectual gravitas of an exhibit and the marketing pull of what you could do with an exhibit to make it get more people through the door. A great example that we did at the Barbican years ago was a Victor and Rolf exhibition, which is major quirky fashion. We could have said fashion and got people through the door in an instant, and we did. We had a club night and we had all sorts of interesting ways of looking at fashion in a really light touch, frivolous way, you could argue, but it engaged a whole lot of people with an art gallery that they hadn't been to before. We talked about this before, this hierarchy of engagement with different cultural venues. But then you can have the intellectual discussion whereby you get the editor of a high profile magazine, an art historian and a fashion commentator discussing why the pieces are culturally significant. And if you can do that in St. Albans Museum and Gallery, you can talk about the history that we've got in a really detailed and constructive way to understand how the history of the building and the history of the city informs the way that people use the space now. But you can also have people dressing up in jail costumes and pretending that they're in the dock. And I think those two can sit perfectly happily in the same building. Just because something isn't the way that it was before doesn't mean that it's automatically bad. And I think the way that people consume culture, the way that people consume a city and the way that people experience a city and what they look for in a cultural experience and in a tourism experience is changing. And I think we can't be snobby about that. I think we can make sure that our branding talks about what we aspire to. If you think about different cities in the country, you won't realise it, but their branding has in some way or another, whether it's formally or informally, spoken to you about what you think about that city. Hull, for example, had their Year of Culture a few years ago. Hilarious feedback from the community when they got their Year of Culture, with somebody on Twitter saying, there's more culture in the pot of yoghurt in my fridge. But then, by the end of the year, they'd actually told everyone, well, to quote a mug that they had printed, come to Hull, it's not anymore. I won't swear on your radio programme. And so you can turn a voice around, but if you talk about an other town in the north that's down on its luck, you have a thought about what that city means, but you think that York might be this or Winchester might be this, and you have an idea in your mind about what kind of offer. Your offer from Windsor is going to be different from the offer from Harrow. And that's just because people have in their minds what these kinds of cities want to be, what they aspire to be and what they offer. I think in St. Albans, and I think more generally in tourism, the way that tourism has to go is almost creating a playbook for the businesses, for the residents, with an idea of what the city is, so that when people talk about their city, they are engaged with it and they say, oh, our city is quirky, our city is engaging, historical, our city is open to all. So, for example, the conference I went to recently, London has come up with three messages, and they have decided these messages carefully to appeal to different audiences. Now, they don't actively say them in taglines, but their three messages are: London is a creative energy. So that would appeal to business and to culture and encouraging businesses to work in a creative environment. A city of old versus new, which particularly appeals to a Chinese audience, which is incredibly important for London tourism. And then this other idea is the city of opportunity, which is partly for students and partly for business. And they've taken those three brands and those three slightly intersecting but slightly separate narratives to appeal in a particular way to particular international audiences, to make sure that their partners, when they talk about London and when the tourism gods of London talk about the city to others, that they're all singing off mostly the same song sheet, and individual brands can interpret that as they wish. But for example, Visit Britain puts on a display of London at most gay prides around the world because they want to show that we are a creative city, we're an inclusive city, we're a city of opportunity, and that speaks to the right audience with the right message, with the right engagement that promotes that city in the way that everybody's agreed on. St. Albans doesn't have that at the moment.
Two questions within. One, we must come back then to investment, because you have to invest, you have to spend in order to achieve anything.
Absolutely.
Where's the money? My guess, London's got a lot more than we have to play with.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, are you saying that there's a potential or actual conflict between those of us who are residents saying, look, this is a 2,000-year-old city, we've got wonderful features, we don't want to be trampled all over. You know, even when the market gets too busy, when you get people coming from Watford and Boreham Wood, I mean, can't we just keep it local?
Yes.
Is there a conflict between that? And I would guess the aspirations of the commercial, the businesses, is get as many people as you can, bring them quality people.
Well, exactly. And I think the nice thing is that actually I can answer both those questions with the same answer. And the lovely thing is that the businesses want the right audience. If we're going to be snobbish about it, everybody wants the right audience. You want the audience that will come, that will engage with the city in the way that you want to, and will spend their money, spend their time, respect, and I keep using the word engage, that's what it is, experience the city. The money is tight. Money is always tight. And tourism is, and marketing is one of those costs that it's how long's a piece of string. And you could just keep on talking about a city. And it's incredibly hard to pinpoint, well, I saw that poster at King's Cross and therefore that's what got me here. But that article that you paid for in this thing, you can't break down that spend. And so it becomes really difficult trying to justify individual spends. However, what you can do, if you create this playbook that businesses feel they can chime into and that they can work alongside, then you can have the pub talking about St. Albans and the place that it is located within, chiming their brand into and playing alongside that St. Albans brand, because nobody, although you may come just for a pub, you may come just for a market stall, the likelihood is that there needs to be two or three reasons to get you to visit a city that you wouldn't otherwise normally. So if you can get the messages that everybody is talking about to be along the same lines, then collectively the spend of all those different micro and larger organisations within the city will all be speaking off the same song sheet, and actually the budgets will be much more disparate but will be all spent in the same direction. The interesting element as well that's developing is that strategic place branding, which is ultimately the byline of what we're talking about, it can be fed into all different areas of talking about place. I think the days of talking about a city as residence community and as a tourism attraction and as an economic centre for development, and those being three siloed subjects, is gone. People will make a decision about where they want to work based on where they can go for a drink afterwards and where the schools are good and where the local community is friendly and all those different decisions. And so if your brand of your identity of your city speaks to all those different audiences and is relevant and appropriate, you'll encourage economic development, you'll encourage investment, you'll encourage new businesses to set up because they want to align their brand with your brand. You'll encourage the visitors to come to engage with that brand, and you'll encourage the residents to speak about that brand, to want to live there and to want to work there. Just to be clear, none of this means that everyone's going to be walking around with a script in their pocket. It's not about that kind of didactic forcing. It's about getting a feeling about a city right. And I think it's going to be a process over the next year or so between the St. Albans Visitor Partnership, which includes all of the attractions, all the venues, all the people that are creating attractions and reasons to visit in the district, between the council, between the BID and the city centre businesses, probably between the district parishes as well, and other community groups and stakeholders who want to have a conversation about what St. Albans is to them. Because if we suddenly announce from the rooftops, we've decided that St. Albans is going to be X, it will get laughed out of the room. It has to come from the grass up. It has to be authentic, because then it will chime with people's experiences of the city.
How can you get people to contribute to the thinking? You said at the beginning, St. Albans is a very engaged, the local community is very engaged. I'm not sure how many, quotes, creative industries other than nice retail shops. I mean, I don't know if there's a lot of IT stuff going around. I know
on the contrary, there very much is.
But they're not so visible, are they, to us?
Exactly that. So there's a fantastic virtual reality company in St. Albans City Centre. They were the ones who kindly funded completely gratis the projection onto the clock tower last year because their offices happened to overlook the clock tower. They don't work with St. Albans businesses. They happen to sit there because the owner didn't want to commute into London every day. And so they have to work particularly hard to attract young professional designer creatives who would otherwise be in Soho into St. Albans. There's loads of creative businesses in St. Albans. There's marketing, there's research, there's a number of different businesses. in answer to your original question, how do we engage the community? The great thing about, I keep going back to social media, and it's not that it's a cheat sheet, it's that fact that people are already expressing their opinions there. Canterbury recently did a similar project where they had a destination management plan funded by the Business Improvement District. What they discovered is that the DMO, the destination management organisation of Visit Canterbury and Visit Kent, were talking about Canterbury and showcasing photography within their marketing campaigns that bore no relation to how people were talking about it on Instagram. Instagram is an incredibly visual medium, if your listeners don't know. It's basically, it's largely large photographs, beautifully poised to the extent of, you know, airbrushing and insanity sometimes. But the photographs that Canterbury Tourism were putting out were, look at this beautiful building, look at this lovely architecture, look at this very nice statue. And it was all relatively formal, quite traditional, and overly respectful of the built environment and of the old. What Instagram was showing is that loads of people were visiting, but they were taking pictures of their kids sticking their tongues out in front of X, or them messing about on the river, or their plate of food surrounded by people and not just the old building that the restaurant happened to be in. And until you chime with those people and those audiences, you're never going to amplify that voice, because actually you're not promoting your city in the way that people are experiencing it. And also you're not then saying you too can have this experience as well. And so most of their destination management plan says is a complete change in photography style. The messaging, people know Canterbury, and actually the challenge with Canterbury is giving people a reason to visit. That's their problem. I don't think people know about St. Albans. And even if they do, I don't think that they have an understanding of the range of opportunity that we've got. The challenge, of course, is that Stratford's got Shakespeare. York's got Vikings and an abbey. And yeah, you know, and it's relatively succinct. I think the challenge that we've got, being a day's ride from London, is that we have so many equally impressive but isolated attractions. It's quite hard to pull it together into one message. And I think what I want to see over the next year, and what we're looking at doing with Enjoy St. Albans, the tourism website, is trying to create the narrative of there being lots of different reasons to come here without it being, we've got loads of stories, you choose which one you like. That, I think, is going to be a little bit of a challenge, because there's so many different ways to engage and so many different audiences. It can feel that there's something for everybody, so just come along. But everyone knows that something for everybody means nothing for no one. The other challenge, of course, is the fact in a restaurant and a clock tower, and there's a small plaque on the wall. And not least of all, the other element, which is what's taught in schools. And so there's a fantastic segment of tourism audience called the Travelling Education Group, which you'd think is sort of the 18-year-olds. It's not. It's the middle-class families who basically go on weekends away in order to further their children's education. The translation of that is, if your kids are doing Romans, you might go to York for the weekend, stick them in the Jorvik Museum, and then you can go out for dinner and not feel guilty. It's the how do the middle class. It's that audience, and they spend money. And the two words that will put fear in the heart of anyone in St. Albans, because it's not in St. Albans, so I apologise in advance, is Harry Potter. So Harry Potter, I am desperate for one of the new movies to be filmed somewhere, just somewhere. I literally don't care where. Just film, do some scene with somebody with a wand somewhere in the district. It would make life much easier. As it stands, Harry Potter World is one of the biggest attractions in the country. It claims to be Harry Potter World London. And so the vast majority of people that go there either get a bus from King's Cross, or they will get the train to Watford. And Watford Junction Station, if anyone's been to it, is peppered with Harry Potter World. There's your bus. The bus directional signs are in 12 different languages. Get on the bus, go to Harry Potter World and come back again. St. Albans Abbey Line gets you from Watford Junction to St. Albans in 16 minutes. Is there a way that we can tap into that audience? Is there that educational tourism audience where we can say to the families, by all means, take your kids to Harry Potter on the Saturday. Why don't you come and stay over in St. Albans? You can do Romans, you can do the museum, you can have a nice free cultural weekend away where it's not all death by kids with wands. I say this with a lot of love for Harry Potter, so this is all relatively tongue-in-cheek, but I do think that there's an audience there that we are not capitalising on, partly because people don't see St. Albans as local to Harry Potter World. They don't know about all the things that St. Albans offers, and the number of people who travel across the country to come 15 minutes away from us and we are not tapping into that is a massive untapped opportunity that I think we really ought to work on.
We're running out of time. What are you going to do next? What's next on this front then?
So St. Albans Business Improvement District has spent the last year working with the Visitor Partnership to create enjoystalbans.com's new facelift. And so we've taken the URL and we've worked together to create an entirely new website. And what that website is seeking to do, rather than being a death by listing site, it is looking to work with voices and influencers and all those lovely buzzwords to create top five places to go for a drink, top 10 places to see Roman history, and those kinds of ways that people engage with tourism decisions now, rather than just this is the city, these are the attractions, these are the opening times. So it's going to be much more content editorial led and very visual. So if anyone has not been on Enjoy St. Albans for a while, then pop along. It's very beautiful. So enjoystalbans.com is launched and fabulous. BID is going to be looking at now pulling together all the different audiences, all the different messages, and seeing with the St. Albans Visitor Partnership what a messaging destination management plan for the city might look like. And then we're going to be working on Instagram and social feeds to try and pull those messages together, and then talking to our businesses about how they can work with that brand to help emphasize and elevate their own messages to align with what we're talking.
Okay, and if anybody wants to put their two penneth in and communicate, what do they use? Twitter?
Twitter's a great one for conversations. I think if I would love to hear what people think about tourism, what they think about their community, and what they think about what St. Albans stands for. So if you go to Twitter, our St. Albans BID handle is @St. Albans_BID. On Twitter, or us, we're obviously on Facebook and Instagram as well, and have a chat and tell us what you think.
Thanks, Ella.
Thank you very much.
See you soon.